kids. That's Segundo here, and I'm nursing a heavy head and a broken heart. Lindsay, if you're out there, I'm sorry I wasn't able to perform. My Viagra ran out, but I'm getting a fresh supply flown in from Tijuana. Thank you, Jorge. Please, please come back to me. I've read the Kama Sutra. Well, it goes without saying that I sneer down on the low-class form of AM radio. I leave that milieu for the right-wing demagogues or the hopelessly unhip. However, I'm willing to give this week's guest a bit of a break. Our young roving correspondent talked with A.M. Holmes and was terrified of asking her what the A and the M stood for. Personally, I think it might stand for Audit Molester, but that's just a stab in the dark. You never know what you're getting with these women who insist on initials instead of real names. You might forget. Was it Lindsay last night, or was it Margaret? At this point, either one will do.
So I am here with the one, the only, A.M. Holmes, who is actually braving the somewhat chilly weather here outside San Francisco, although the sun has come out and now it appears to have disappeared. But A.M., how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
So recently the author of an interesting title, This Book Will Save Your Life. Now, the title of this book certainly kind of calls attention to itself. I guess, was there a secret desire on your part to sort of see if this book might be categorized in the self-help section instead of the fiction section?
No, there was no secret desire. I often have a title before I finish writing a book.
Really?
And it's funny because things like Things You Should Know and Safety of Objects, I have a history of these kind of declarative titles. And I finished the whole of this novel and I really didn't know what it was going to be called. And the agent said to me, well, what are you going to call it? And I sort of literally was sitting there thinking, I have no idea. And I thought, well, you know, this book will save your life. She's like, that'll do.
Well,
so it wasn't particularly premeditated in any way.
It certainly is a very attention-grabbing title, though. Now, I wanted to ask you, first of all, Richard is sort of a very affluent man going through a midlife crisis. And I was wondering, because this just very seemed reminiscent of John Updike's Rabbit Armstrong, or even Richard Ford's Frank Bascombe, or even, like, you know, most recently Chang Ray Lee's Aloft, Jerry Battle and that. I was wondering if this book was your answer to sort of the male menopause kind of novel.
No. I never thought of it that way, as a male menopause novel. No, I think that historically my influencers are more like Richard Yates, you could look at Revolutionary Road, or Cheever, you know, The Swimmer, sort of, I think is that sort of version of a midlife crisis book. I think it's really about, you know, a passage in a person's life, and it's not so much about a guy, and it's not so much about affluence. It's really just about, you know, what do you do when you kind of have what looks like everything, but you really have nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you kind of find your way back to your life?
Well, I wanted to ask you about, like, your use of language in this book. There are many moments I found in which language takes on a sort of, you know, how commercialism has kind of been appropriated, or rather, sincerity has been appropriated by commercialism.
Mm-hmm.
You have at the beginning, you know, the paramedics telling Richard you're in good hands. You have the receptionist asking, would you like to be validated? I guess, was this intended as a sort of targeted commentary on, you know, the war against sincerity, where, you know, we have nothing left because these, you know, corporations and the like keep sort of taking the words out of our mouths?
No, you know, it's so funny. I mean, I on the one hand, I look at phrases like that, would you like to be validated?
Mm-hmm.
And that was really drawn in the funny way from something that happened to me. I went into Neiman Marcus and slapped my parking ticket and said, violate me once, meaning validate me. And they just looked at me like, what are you, nuts? So, I mean, I'm aware of those kind of phrases really becoming actually part of the culture. And I think when you overhear people talking, and often actually when I hear people talking in a business context, I'm really shocked by kind of the tone they're using and the language they're using, which feels very kind of manicured and cold in a way. But it's funny, I was thinking when you were bringing up the use of language that one of the things about this book that strikes me is that there's a lot of kind of very rhythmic language and a lot of kind of elaborating on a single theme. So it'll talk about, you know, what kind of pain he's in, throbbing, stabbing, dull. It'll talk about, you know, sort of expositions on a single kind of notion in a way. But I hadn't thought of it so much in terms of sincerity or commercialism.
I don't know, but, you know, it seems to me that just it's really sort of frustrating that one can't be sincere in this age because, you know, they're taking our...
Because Hallmark beat you to it?
Hallmark beat us all to it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, that does worry me. I think that it would be nice to also be able to be absurd and satirical and sincere. Like, you should be able to tolerate all of that at once. You know, you look at Vonnegut's work, and Vonnegut's early work was all of those things. Mm-hmm. He meant it 100%. He meant it earnestly. And yet no one gave him a hard time for being sincere about it. And I think this book is sort of sincere, and that kind of bothers people.
Yeah, yeah. It's yeah. received some interesting reviews, which we'll talk about in just a sec. But even in Vonnegut's case, like, you know, you have him, you know, taking a leak, for example.
Yes.
He also played off of the notion of idioms in our culture and all that.
Sure.
To what extent, I mean, are you sort of, you know, obsessed with idioms? There seems to be a lot that runs throughout your work.
Until you mentioned it, I never thought I was. you know, I think it's always important to me to watch the streets being clean.
Yes.
You know, it's always very important to me to try to reflect the culture and reflect the world that we're living in. And I think part of that is through the language and through the language of the moment, which on the one hand, you don't want to kind of devalue your work or make it so time sensitive that it only works in the thing. I also think a lot of it in some ways is actually a play on words.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking those sort of catchphrases and, I don't know, turning them around a little bit.
Well, in terms of Richard's sort of vernacular, was this sort of kind of an issue when you were kind of stylizing the dialogue or, you know, the kind of playing?
I have to say, it's not something that I think about a lot. You know, I just sort of sit down and do it. Now I'm going to be thinking about it a whole lot, Ed, so thank you.
Sorry about that. Well,
I'm
never going to read an A.M. Holmes novel and analyze the hell out of it again.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
You know, it's funny because I think about language a lot, definitely. And I think a lot about sort of philosophical ideas, but I've never thought about the language in that way. Mm-hmm. Although I see exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think there is something there. I just haven't thought about it.
Huh. Okay. Well, think about it.
The power of the unconscious. Exactly.
Well, actually, I mean, I wanted to talk about sort of the narrative style of this book.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of do something, well, you do something very interesting in the way that you sort of cloak the characters. We don't know who's going to be a prominent character and who isn't. You know, for example, the Cynthia character, you know, until she makes her second appearance, I was like, wait, she was just some minor character, wasn't she? And then she becomes this sort of seminal character who essentially kickstarts Richard's ability to sort of, like, you know, basically, you know, get in touch with other people. And then, in fact, a lot of the last half of the book, you sort of jumpstart and amp up the sort of narrative elements. All of a sudden, it's like, revelation here, revelation there. I'm just curious whether this novel was outlined, whether you were just trying to constantly throw the reader off guard, or whether, you know, you're just kind of writing on adrenaline and seeing what happened. I mean, maybe you can talk about this.
Sure. None of those are true. No. I definitely don't outline. I mean, I tend to make a lot of notes, and I'll make notes going forward and something. I think the interesting thing here, the sort of difficulty, was trying to figure out how and when to introduce various people. Like the fact that Nick, this other kind of major character, really doesn't come in until the second half. And on the one hand, that made me nervous. I thought I'd never done that before, brought somebody, you know, kind of pivotal in so late into the book. On the other hand, I really felt like I wanted to spend a lot of time, I don't know, for, you know, Richard getting to know himself and Richard kind of finding his way in this kind of, you know, quasi-accidental sort of thing. I mean, he's really stumbling through his life and literally sort of trips over people and people trip over him. And so that wasn't intentional in terms of throwing people off guard. I think I was really just sort of trying to track him and his movements and the juxtapositions of things. It's sometimes hard to cram everything in there in a way.
Was it a matter of sort of like throwing various elements of the world at Richard? Was that your kind of intention with all this?
I think it was more that Richard kind of wakes up and as he's kind of coming back to consciousness, he doesn't have a good filter system. So everything kind of carries equal weight. And everything that sort of he observes or bumps into has a big effect on him. He's suddenly, you know, in a way, very kind of vulnerable, I would say. He goes from being, you know, kind of numb to being almost overly sensitive and overly responsive.
Well, there's also something very interesting with the character names, in which you sort of drop letters. You have Anhill, Anthill, you know, you have Nick without a K.
Okay.
I was wondering if you might talk about that. I mean, also, you know, and part of me was kind of thinking Vertigo with Richard Novak.
Right. That's right, exactly. I love Vertigo. You know, I have to say, in that sense, I don't think about it too much. I mean, I do think about it, and the Nick decision was a real decision. It also, for lack of a better word, seems to me that that's who these people are. That they, it's funny to say, but like the characters bring their own names to the book. It's sort of like, I often will be surprised. I always think, is that really who you are? Is that your name? Where did you come from?
Well, here I was actually thinking it was a clever sort of pun, like on a K-hole or something.
Know. You know, Richard. You know,
for Nick, But perhaps that was accidental.
And I think you're just far too smart a reader. You must have been a literature student at some point.
Well, yeah, I'm actually going back into grad school.
See?
So yeah, there we go.
You'll do well.
Yeah. well, anyway, but how were? But we kind of didn't really get into this.
Sure.
Like, how were these? How did these names sort of come about? The sort of not kind of reminiscent of sort of English nouns, but not. You know, because they're dropping the letters. I mean,
really, they just for me, it comes out of. It feels, until you mention it again, Ed, it feels naturally occurring. It feels like it comes out of the character. I mean, I sort of will have an idea of the character of Von Hill or the donut guy or of Nick. And they don't name themselves immediately. They don't always arrive with a name. But then I sort of, it's just sort of an organic process. It's weird. It's not like I put enormous amounts of thought in. But I think what you're also sort of seeing is there is an enormous amount of, for lack of a word, unconscious work that goes on, and unconscious decision making that kind of all conspire to become part of a whole.
I want to talk to you about the donuts and why the donut as the sort of round kind of American victual as opposed to, say, a burger or a bagel or something like that.
I think the donut is a thing of old-fashioned quality.
Mm-hmm.
A bagel is kind of an ethnic and newfangled food, although
it's just as much as coffee.
Yeah,
exactly.
But I think the donut is kind of the classic American thing in terms of you go to the donut shop for comfort. It is a warm place. It's a kind of a cross between a bakery and a bar.
Yeah.
You know, in some way.
Yeah.
I think the donut business is a business that an immigrant can go into in some way, hoping for something big. I just like donuts. They seem to me warm. I also like that there's been a sort of a reinvention of the donut. So now you have the kind of organic donut and all these kind of different donut flavors. It's just a kind of a classic item.
Well, a
burger, especially, you know, today you got the mad cow stuff. You got all kind of other issues that I would have to deal with those.
The donut then is sort of, I guess, a more pleasant concoction to dwell upon than say something like a burger, which is like in our
dead cow.
Now health conscious kind of society.
Exactly.
Huh. Oh, yeah, well, I know what you mean. I mean, I actually have a donut shop in my neighborhood, which I'm not really much of a donut fan, but because the donut shop actually exists, I actually did now frequent the place every so often.
See?
So, you know, I mean.
And doesn't it just make you happy to know that it's there?
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, there's nothing negative about a donut store.
Well, although, truthfully, it's like if I run out of coffee, it's the only thing open at 6 in the morning in the neighborhood. But, I wanted to talk about the Good Samaritan media onslaught.
Yes, exactly.
Sort of suggested to me that, you know, basically, the attention given to a good deed outweighs the sort of actual nobility of the deed itself. Maybe you could sort of talk about how you kind of made this sort of really crazed kind of like the Today Show calling.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think on the one hand, that's exactly true, that the attention that is given to a good deed does kind of like destroy the good deed in a certain way, because it doesn't become then about the good intention behind something. It becomes about something else, like you're famous for doing something good, or you're, you know, notable for that. So that was just a little tiny twist in the whole thing that interested me. One of the things that also interested me was the idea of kind of everyday heroism, that somebody does kind of begin to sort of take on these acts that are slightly, you know, larger than life. I would say I also, it's so funny, I sort of fundamentally believe in the good deed.
Mm-hmm.
I actually believe in the anonymous good deed and doing things for other people that other people never know that you do. I mean, in my experience, on the sort of more personal side, that's the greatest pleasure, is not, you know, having somebody know that you've done it. That said, I also think that we are a society in which if somebody started to behave heroically, we would attempt to consume that person and to replicate that person and document that person and you know, really do everything possible to ruin the whole idea.
Well, it touches upon something you said recently in a interview with the Missouri Review, where you suggested that you would hope that this novel would inspire more social responsibility, but then you also stated that you worried that you had gone too far. Now, I was wondering if you might be able to talk about this. I mean, you've built up a reputation as something of a provocateur, and do novelists have any business being ethicists?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, I think it's funny that you say that, because I think even my most provocative novels are really about morality and ethics in some way, and really about having a conversation about those things. As much as I'm, you know, known to be sort of provocative and transgressive, I think cultural responsibility and accountability is kind of at core of everything I've written.
But even this book, it's sort of like, it's a little bit, it's not as provocative as your other books. Did you, I mean, and then towards the end, all of a sudden, all these grand slam revelations. Yeah. I was wondering, did you, like, sort of felt that you, I've been too safe. I need to sort of, like, you know, go ahead and pull out all the stops. I mean, what was happening?
No, not at all. I mean, I think, you know, my goal for this book was to sort of continue to do what I do and really work hard to sort of, I don't know, be there with the character. And I would say Richard, in some ways, was a hard character because in the beginning of the book, he's not conscious. He's really not aware of himself. So it's hard to get to know somebody who doesn't know themselves. So I think that's part of why, not that it necessarily takes a while to get going, but why the second half is kind of really jam-packed and the first half might feel a little bit different. In terms of kind of moral accountability, or thinking I was playing it too safe, not at all. You know, I really wanted to write a book that was sort of apocalyptic yet uplifting. I think that it is just as important to be inspiring as it is to, you know, try to provoke a conversation about a very dark and serious subject. I think they're both important. I would honestly say, you know, I feel like we're living in a fairly dark time in this country, and I felt like maybe there was something to be said for trying to, write my way out of that, you know, just sort of philosophically.
Gotcha.
And also just the fact that, you know, I was talking about this a little bit today with some people. You know, I was in New York for 9/11. I watched it outside of my apartment window. I mean, I saw those planes come in. I saw one of them coming in. And I think when you see things that are larger than what you can sort of fathom in your imagination, it does sort of change you. And it does sort of make you, I think, more aware that we are indebted to each other and we are responsible for each other. And it shouldn't just be on a day when something horrible happens. It should be every day that we sort of express that awareness and that concern for others.
Well, I think we saw that with Katrina, you know. I mean,
absolutely,
irrespective of the government screw-up, I mean, there was all that money that came in through the Red Cross.
Right, you know. Absolutely. That's a really good example of it. Yeah. On the other hand, somebody I know's, a friend of their mother in Texas, had taken in two people who were supposedly, you know, Katrina survivors, and she was actually murdered by them.
Mm.
In front of one of their small children. They, like, hit her over the head with a lamp and killed
her.
Wow. I know, weird, right?
But, you know, that's kind of the risk you take in life.
Absolutely,
I mean,
I just think it's that sort of awful side of, you know, you try to sort of make the decent and good gesture and then you get bitten for it.
But then this is the whole myth of zero tolerance. You know, it's like you cannot have a zero tolerance kind of society.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, inevitably there's going to be some bad things that are going to happen. But,
absolutely.
But in the end, the good things far outweigh the bad, at least. That's
on a good day. Right?
On a good day.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, I know there's some cynical stuff in your books, but, you know. Oh, yeah, I wanted to talk about Stephen King championed this book, and he called it a generational touchstone, yet the reviews have been, we've got an ambulance or something, a fire engine. It's a normal day in the city.
The reviews have been?
Well, the reviews have been mixed, and I was wondering if you think that maybe King's kind of plaudits have sort of, you know, maybe nixed your chances of this novel being understood by people.
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things, of all the books I've written, this is the book that I would have least suspected would get kind of the intensely kind of vitriolic reviews that it's gotten a few of. I found that, on the one hand, sort of shocking, and it reminded me of how incredibly naive I still am after all these years.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't see it coming. Whether or not, in some way, it's in part a response to Stephen King for his kind words for the book, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the thing that meant the most to me about what Stephen King said was that, in some ways, Stephen King is a guy like a Richard Novak. He is a guy who's incredibly successful, who lives a somewhat sheltered life or a somewhat isolated life by virtue of how he lives, and that this book meant something to him and resonated, meant to me as a sort of a younger woman writer, that I got it right, that I captured what it meant to be a guy in a situation like that. And that to me is actually, you know, the greatest part of it. It's so hard to know what critics are thinking or why they think what they think. I mean, I think one of the other things that I imagine people are struggling with is several of the really negative reviews have been written by young women. And I think there may be something about a middle-aged guy's vulnerability that they hate. Like, it's funny to say they're man-hating reviewers in some way. I mean, I think there might be a grain of truth to it. It's just, I don't really know. I mean, there's an intensity to some of them that's kind of inexplicable.
Or the fact that, like, you know, maybe there's some sort of, that's interesting, I notion, yeah. The idea that if a woman writes about a man, it's not acceptable, but a man can write about a woman, and it's, you know, totally acceptable.
Well, it's that, but I also think it may be that something about Richard being incredibly vulnerable, yeah. And a little bit down is scary to people, is scary to young women, because they need the men in their lives and the men that they sort of, I don't know, look up to or want to date or marry to be somehow stronger than that and more solid.
Or more certain Japanese ladies who work for the New York Times.
Yes.
But Chico really, really kind of, you know, got out the sort of, you know, the axe,
yes,
of
did.
This. But I wanted to actually talk about that because there is...
You know, I find it difficult to believe because, you know, she and I are such close friends. But she would know.
Yeah, yeah, no. No, Machiko, Machiko's...
I've never met her.
Yeah, Machiko's... Well, no one's ever met her. Exactly. I think Machiko is like a machine that occasionally spouts off a sort of Holden Caulfield spoof or something. But no, I don't know. But I wanted to talk about something that she did actually mention, and that is the gargantuan moments in this book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the sort of gargantuan moments in all of your books. I mean, you have, in this one, the sinkhole. You have the horse, the movie star neighbor. In the opening of Music for Torching, you have the married couple attempting to set their house on fire. And Machiko basically said, you know, hey, you gravitate toward deliberately sensationalistic material. But I wanted to get an answer on this from you. Should fiction strive to be sensationalistic, or does it risk being cartoonish in the process?
Well,
should there
be
a ceiling or something? Or?
I mean, I think what's... you know, funny about what you're asking me is that, you know, 3 days after the book came out, of course, in Los Angeles, a house fell into a sinkhole. And interestingly, the facade stayed intact and only the middle of the house fell into the sinkhole with the poor guy living in it in the middle part, who then died because they couldn't get him out in time. The over-the-top things that are in this book, by and large, have all happened. And historically, in all of my books, the majority of things happen. So it's a little creepy, honestly, because, Music for Torching came out 3 weeks before Columbine. This book went into the editor, and originally the ending of this book was going to be a tsunami. And I backed away from the tsunami because I thought, they never happen. And then, no joke, like 3 weeks later, there's the tsunami. And I thought, well, you can't do that now. And simultaneously, I started getting emails from the editor about this large tiger that was roaming around the Reagan Library in California. And then, no joke, you know, a month later, in probably January of last year, the book is already in production, and I was in Los Angeles driving up the Pacific Coast Highway, and right where I wrote it, there was a landslide while I was watching. And I had never seen one in person before, and I would say it was kind of hauntingly beautiful, but it was like the hillside just turned to liquid and came pouring down onto the Pacific Coast Highway, closing the highway. So on the one hand, I would say you can't make this stuff up. On the other hand, I would also acknowledge that there is a kind of my fiction is a very much a compressed reality, and it is, I think of it like as Kodachrome hues. They are super saturated. They are brighter than bright and realer than real, but there's, for the most part, it's funny to say there's nothing in there that doesn't happen. You know, people gave me a hard time when I wrote a story about a woman who has a chip implanted in her, a woman with Alzheimer's, a tracking chip. And, you know, 6 months after I wrote the story, people started calling me, oh, did you see that? That was on Nightly News tonight. I mean, it's all about reading the culture. And if you're reading the culture, even though it takes 4 years to write a book, I mean, hopefully, I mean, I like to feel like if I'm doing a good job, I'm reading ahead slightly. And I'm you know, it's all coming soon to a theater near you, you know?
Well, it's also maybe a situation where, you know, right now the current kind of contemporary literature climate is that, you know, oh, we have to have this kind of muted realism, the sort of B.R. Myers kind of thing. And maybe maybe some critics are perhaps intimidated by the idea of, like, decorum being sort of brushed off or something. And, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that for me, it comes from something, and I remember talking actually to the painter Eric Fischel about this. I can't bear for something to be going on and people not to see it. Mm-hmm. So if I have to make it really inescapably clear, I will make it inescapably clear, but I don't want someone to deny something that's happening. I mean, even in this book, you know, Nutty Things, the feral chihuahuas are real. I didn't make that up. I mean, on the one hand, I really do work for my imagination. On the other hand, I'm just pulling it right out of what's out there.
What do you do to, you know, sort of fill up the information tanks here? I mean, what do you just constantly sort of like...
walk around.
I mean, you're saying that a lot of this comes from reality. Are these newspaper articles, personal experience, a mixture of...
All things. I mean, to write the book, this book will save your life, I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles. I had National Geographic had said to me, we'll send you anywhere in the world you want to go, but you have to write a memoir about it.
Yeah.
And I, knowing I wanted to write a novel about Los Angeles, said, I'll go and live at the Chateau Marmont in Hollywood. And so I wrote a book about it, but really that was the excuse to get me out there to do the research. So a lot of it really is everything from interviewing people in Los Angeles, whether it's people who deal with like the literal geography to the tar pits to all those things, reading a lot of history about Los Angeles, just talking to people and walking around and being in those places. It's all kinds of things, and absolutely reading the papers and reading the local papers. And you know, I love like a good small town newspaper because I think they have a whole different kind of story than the New York Times.
Yeah.
And I'm always collecting little bits and pieces about, I don't know, people and places and things.
I wanted to sort of backtrack a bit because I did address that Missouri Review interview and you actually sort of segued your way out of that. But I mean, what did you mean by like you think that you had gone too far with this book?
I honestly don't know. So I wasn't trying to avoid it. I'm not sure. You know, it's funny because it's the interview is an edited thing and I don't know really what the context of it was
yeah.
or where the line stopped and started. So I don't feel like in any way this book goes too far. I mean,
I think it was pertaining to social responsibility, basically.
Yeah, I don't think you can go too far with social responsibility. I think it's a really important thing and something that we just, every generation sequentially since I've grown up or whatever, seems to be less and less socially responsible.
Does fiction have any kind of limits for you? Or?
I hope not.
I mean, do you place some sort of ceiling on what you will write about or how far you will go?
No, not at all. I mean, I would say, you know, the things that I'm sort of now interested in are almost fantasy or science fiction. I'm interested in superheroes. You know, I think the Richard thing is sort of a setup for that in some way, and also for things about shapeshifters. I had written a few short stories in the last book that had shapeshifters in them. No, I really think I want to just go further and further. I mean, I think I want to write about our world and our times, but I also think there are times when to do that you have to leave it and go elsewhere. I mean, I also wouldn't mind, you know, going and living in Europe for a year or two and writing a book there.
So you're actually kind of, it seems to me that you're interested in exploring the line between reality and hyper-reality. Is that the kind of gray area that interests you? Or?
No, I think it's more exploring a kind of psychological experience, which is, you know, always the difference between sort of who we are and who we think we are and who we want to be, and maybe to some degree how the world perceives us, but even the gaps between things. That's really what always interests me, is, you know, spaces between things.
I wanted to actually talk about the strange ass fetish in this book. There are a lot of... this is actually interesting.
That's so funny. Ass fetish? Is that what you
well,
said?
Well, yeah, because... Really? Well, I guess...
Tell
I guess,
me more.
Well, okay. I talked with Sheila Hedy, and I had pointed out to her that the one sort of sexual moment in the book concerned sort of like, you know, basically staring at a woman's bottom.
Uh-huh.
And this... Same right. thing with this. The sort of sexual moment in here, with the exception of the sort of interesting scar thing...
Right.
Is, again, involving the ass. And it just... I'm just noticing a theme among some women novelists. It's like the ass is the sort of the great kind of, like,
right.
you know, equalizer among genders.
Right.
But maybe you can elaborate on this theory.
I don't quite know what to say. All I can sort of do is give you a tip off that there's a whole chapter in my next book called My Father's Ass. I don't know. You know, I think the ass is a nice thing. We all have one. I always remember Harold Brodkey writing this wonderful, I don't remember what short story it was in, this idea he had where he would take his ass off and lift it up and put it on his chest, his breasts. And I thought that was so Brodkey, and he wrote it so incredibly eloquently and beautifully that it was just amazing. Hmm. But beyond that, I'm going to have to go back and look at my ass. Now, look at the ass as represented
in
this novel.
No, but I mean, Richard's ass is thoroughly scooped throughout the book.
Right.
It just seemed a very, very interesting choice, I
yeah.
guess.
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if it was, if you were going for imagery
don't
or
metaphor.
Don't
write your dissertation on this.
No.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'd have to, I'll have to call my therapist and ask her, and then she can call you back.
I don't know if it was like, you know, a sinkhole, you know, tied into that, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, you could do a lot with it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you don't have to really explain Richard's health scare. It kind of goes sort of unannounced, but at the same time, there's a lot of characters who appear in this book who hope, you know, who are largely charlatans and quacks.
Right.
And this seemed to me, again, going back to sort of the disparity we were talking about earlier about, like, you know, a good deed versus the media coverage.
Right.
I wanted to sort of talk about when you have sort of, you know, an ailment or a deed or something that kind of affects someone existentially, I suppose,
right.
Versus the actual reaction. Now, this seems to be kind of a commonality, you know, both with this and also with the good deeds. And I was wondering, now that I'm obfuscating big
right.
time, you know, what do you think that fiction, is the purpose of your fiction these days to sort of explore the kinds of reactions to sort of human behavior? It seems that there is like, there's no cause for it. You know, there's no cause for the good deed or for the ailment, but there is
right.
certainly a reaction by other people that it almost eclipses that. And
right.
That just seems, that's very interesting to me.
I hadn't thought about it. I mean, I would say, you know, there definitely is cause for the good deed or the ailment. It's just not elaborated on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we sort of arrive, you know, at the beginning of the book, and there's already this sort of situation in progress. Tell me again the question.
Well, I guess I was pointing to the to the ailment versus
right.
you know, the fact that it's basically quacks that are trying to fix the
sure,
ailment.
Sure, exactly.
Just as like with the good deed,
right.
you have the media sort of like
yeah.
covering the good deed, and it's sort of like completely out of proportion
right.
to the actual.
Right. I mean, I think the question about the quack thing is interesting. I mean, it's all interesting, but in terms of the quack thing, I think one of the things that comes up is, it's hard to know if Lusardi really is a quack or not.
I mean,
on the one hand, the service and the care that he provides Richard is genuine and heartfelt. On the other hand, the guy is pretending to be a doctor
yeah.
and he's not
yeah.
one. But I think that actually is a very kind of important question and valid question, because I think we live in a time where everything from, in some ways, we're not helped by the medical profession in the ways we hope to, and the medical profession does not begin to dignify anyone else's help as being valid and not quackery. And I think it's a very fine line between what is helpful to somebody and what that mind-body connection really is. So, you know, and I think the same thing sort of in a funny way with the good deed. I mean, it's hard to know where the good deed stops and starts, and you know, what it means to sort of go public with the good deed. I mean, I think it's not Richard's intention when doing what he's doing to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
He's not doing it because he wants to be a hero in some way. He's doing it because he feels compelled to do it and because of how it makes him feel about himself. I mean, he doesn't participate in the kind of media coverage of his own activities. And I think even he raises the question about Lusardi, you know, what does it mean if the person helps you? Are they still a quack? Or he kind of is angry and baffled by him, but he also wants to find him and sort of talk to him.
But in both cases, it's sort of like you have a cure being presented when it's really not needed.
Right.
And you also have media coverage, like we'll give you an interview, when it's really not needed. But yet the explanation behind the behavior is very private, or behind the
right,
sort of affliction
sure,
is private.
Sure.
And that is a very interesting sort of distinction,
yeah.
I think.
I don't know. I have to think about that more in some way, because I'm not sure what that's all about.
Maybe do you want to kind of preserve sort of private moments that you don't want the reader to sort of, you don't want to give too much to the reader, because the reader, you know, then everything will be explained, but you can't explain life. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, on the one hand, I absolutely do not want to, you know, pretend to have any large explanation of life to people. I want to give them something that is, at the same time as it's, you know, entertaining, it also makes them think and to just sort of look at themselves a little differently. But I don't have an explanation. I honestly don't.
Is it perhaps the Yeats influence talking? Because
I
mean, the old Yeats' stories
yeah.
and novels are like that, where in his case it's different because the moment sort of speaks for itself. But
right.
you don't necessarily understand the exact root cause of the moment, but you have
yeah,
a very
no,
you good idea. You have a
right.
very good idea
right.
for why how these people are operating.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like what what any reader brings to the book with his or her human experience or the
right,
life.
Right. I don't know.
Okay. Okay.
You know, in a funny way, it's interesting because writers really are not always the best people to kind of analyze their work and,
yeah.
and talk about it in that kind of a way.
Yeah.
We're a little dumb when it comes to that. We just make the stuff up. And I mean that, you know, genuinely. I mean, I think it is a process that if you were noticing all of the things that you've noticed that are very astute observations, it would probably be crippling to the novelist as you were trying to write the novel, because you wouldn't be able to write it.
Yeah,
you'd
yeah.
be so busy trying to either do all of those things or wonder what they meant that you would never get past a page.
Fair enough.
But I think that they, you know, I think they're real. I think they're just sort of, they, I don't know, they're all part of the package.
Well, going back...
Oh, for $23.95.
Yeah. The,
order now. If you buy order. Two copies, you get a set of steak knives that I'll send directly to your home.
A nice Glengarry Glen
right,
Ross
exactly,
reference.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Well, that's second prize. That's if they can't actually... That is if the book sells out,
actually.
Right, exactly. Going back to this issue of, like, you know...
Here's the difference. I'm the person who actually bought the steak knives in Kmart in the back for $19.95, and it came with, like, I don't know, a full house of furniture or something, like 20 years ago, and I'm still using those steak knives.
I actually have a pair of knives that I probably shouldn't be using because they're, like, I've sharpened them to death, and they keep on, yeah. I keep on
Mine,
using
Mine, you never have to sharpen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Self-sharpening.
They're self-sharpening, and they, I don't know, you could also use them to fix anything, apparently.
Well, going back to this issue of, like, varying levels... Hello, pigeons. I apologize for the wind and all that, by the way. The varying levels of reality in your work. What do you do to sort of find the sort of acceptable sort of mode of reality that is, like, this is possibly sensationalistic or possibly, you know, this is just nothing but asphyxiation on all sides. I'm so sorry.
I think... And I don't know if this really answers your question. I think that one of the things when you start a novel or a short story is you're thinking of what is the pitch of the piece or what is the, you know, almost like a musical note. What is the tenor that you're going to start off on and what is the sort of angle that that's starting at? Is it, you know, loud? Is it soft? Is it whatever? And I think that, you know, people talk about in some ways as voice, but it's not just voice. And I think that whatever that pitch is, to some degree, leads the way in terms of looking at, you know, the level of reality. I mean, that's part of that pitch. You know, I think for me, it's always a fine line between, you know, reality as we sort of are willing to say we know it and experience it, and reality as it might be. And I have to say, I think that reality has gotten, in and of itself, more surrealistic in the last few years. I mean,
yeah.
It just is, we live in a weird time. You know, we live in a time where people think they are connected. We're constantly on email. We're constantly on our cell phones, reporting our location. And yet, we don't see anybody. We're not talking to anybody. We're just sort of, you know, confirming our existence so that we don't fall off the edge of the earth.
It goes back to the other Kakutani.
Kakamami.
The complaint she had was that you had used too many Los Angeles cliches. But I could play the, you know, devil's advocate here and say, well... If you're going to report something, there are going to be common details that everyone is going to sort of notice.
Right.
And to what extent does something, does a detail or does
become
an observation become a cliche? And is this a concern for you as a writer?
It wasn't a concern until she did that. In all honesty, it's not a concern. I mean, I feel like, you know, with this book, I really wanted it to be fresh. I really wanted it to be of the world that it was, you know, from. It's not like I set out thinking like, oh, I'm going to use all those cliches, nor do I want to be sort of thought to be somebody who is so not paying attention that I'm using them without thinking about it. I think there is a common frame of reference. There is a common set of imagery. And I would like to think that, you know, it's not just cliche. It's both a kind of a linguistic code in some way, you could say. It is a kind of a vocabulary. And that it's also something more, that it becomes something that is relevant to the characters and to the story that's being told.
So atmosphere to you is a linguistic code, then?
Yes.
No, I mean, no, I'm serious. I want to...
No, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know. I just think that I don't walk around thinking about cliches, nor have I, before this, been described as somebody who, you know... I mean, I think the other thing is that we all sort of somehow think that we know Los Angeles. And in a funny way, you know, as much as everyone thinks they know Los Angeles, this is not a Hollywood novel. Mm-hmm. It is really about a guy who's kind of falling apart and how he pulls himself back together. And yes, one of his neighbors is a movie star. But I think one of the things you see is how, what does that mean to be a movie star? And how does that guy kind of move through his own life? And just the oddity of what it means to be anybody. We all have... an existence and a network, and we all are kind of interwoven, and each piece of ourselves is different. You know, we all fit together differently.
Maybe the whole thing really is because people are really pissed off that Crash won Best Picture, and they see the fact, oh, interconnected film, interconnected.
Well, you know,
book.
And I of course didn't even see that movie yet, which is really annoying.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, though, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, this is not intended as a Hollywood novel, and yet there have been comparisons to Day of the Locust.
Right.
I mean, it's very sort of strange that people are viewing this as a Hollywood novel by way of having a movie star neighbor.
Yeah, I mean, I think, frankly, that, you know, part of it is when a novel is set in Los Angeles, you know, Hollywood is in Los Angeles, and people just want it to be that. I mean, I think, in a funny way, people are applying their own kind of stereotypes and their own cliches to something that maybe isn't about any of those things. I don't know, Ed.
No,
but I just write the books.
But I want to, you know, you were mentioning this interesting thing about atmosphere being a linguistic code. I mean, can you sort of kind of elaborate on this?
Well, you know, the thing I would say, and again, I don't know if this answers your question, is when I write a novel and I think about where is it going to be set and who is going to be in it, you know, there's a big difference between setting a novel in Los Angeles or in a prison or in suburban New York or in New York City. And I think one of the biggest differences is, you know, people's economic structure. So a family that earns, you know, $75,000 a year lives differently in New York City than they live in Los Angeles in some ways, or in a suburb of America. And I think the way that we live is a lot about who we are. And, you know, the way people will have an affair in New York City is different from how people would have an affair in a rural community. I mean, it just, all of those elements conspire not just to make you who you are, but to influence how you do your day, how you have your relationships. That interests me. It's something that, you know, I would say economics of literature is never discussed. You know, Richard's economic life is a really big piece of sort of who he is and how he got to be where he is and where he isn't all at once.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also, you kind of allude to this idea of money being thrown at the problems of these characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, you know, I mean, I agree with you. I think that the two things that aren't really discussed nearly as much in literature are work.
Right.
And economics.
Right.
And how money sort of ties into the way that people live. I mean, it's sort of like, it's almost like there's this sort of like, oh, well, we can't discuss money and things like that because it goes back to sort of Victorian literature, because everything back then was just like, yes, I allocated, you know, so-and-so dollars to pay so-and-so, so-and-so pounds to pay so-and-so, you know. Why do you think there's a stigma against money and economics and work in literature? I mean, what can we do to break
this? I mean, I think it's really interesting. I don't know. I think, you know, somebody should do an anthology of money and literature.
Yeah.
The literature of money. I don't know. It is really interesting, in all honesty. And I also think, you know, P.S., you don't see a lot of people writing books about poor people. And in a way, I'd like to write something about a poor person. I'd like to, you know, inhabit that experience and kind of have a better sense of what does it really mean to think, you know, we all think, oh, I can't, like, I'm all upset because I lost my noise-canceling headsets on this trip.
Yeah.
You know, those are really expensive, but I think, okay, I'll get myself another pair. It's a drag.
Yeah.
But it's not like I'm going to have to wait 6 months to be able to do that. And what does it mean to think, I don't have money for dinner.
Yeah.
I don't have money for rent. I don't have money for electricity. I mean, things that, you know, most of us honestly take for granted. We may try to make what we think are good choices about how we, you know, do our food shopping. We don't buy wildly expensive things. But the fact is, we can essentially buy what we want to buy and have choice in that. And I think it's amazingly powerful and confining to think about what does it mean to not be able to afford to even leave a place.
Well, there's two problems with this, and that is, you know, upper middle class people tend to buy fiction.
Right.
You
mean I can't write The Grapes of Wrath again?
Yeah, no, but, and then conversely, if you do write, you know, like, look at the case of Volman, who, like, struggled for years writing about regular, everyday people and was just, like, castigated for it.
Yeah.
Castigated, you know?
Yeah.
Until finally, you know, being redeemed for, not actually, like, you know, the rainbow stories, but Europe Central, you know? So it's sort of like, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
You're absolutely damned if you do and damned if you don't. And I feel that way. Very much so about, you know, everything that I've been doing, whether it's somebody's like, oh, you know, this work is too dark. Now they're like, oh, this one's too light. There is no, for lack of a word, no winning. And I think that's fine. I'm not, you know, there is no winning. So fine. So what am I going to do? I'm not going to stop doing what I do. My commitment is to trying to sort of, you know, push on with my work, whatever that might be. But I really am interested in the economics of things. And I want to figure out how to write about that.
Is this the next sort of, like, boundary to push through? Or?
I don't know. It would be very interesting if a person pushed through that and wrote a really good novel about poverty.
Yeah.
I think I could soon.
Someone needs to write A Grapes of Wrath right now, basically.
No, and what would that, you know, what would that be? Where are we with that, you know?
You know, there hasn't, I mean, it's really, it's all about, you know, upper middle class. I mean, in fact, the complaint possibly could the criticism here could even be drawn to this book in
right.
the sense that it actually deals exclusively with like upper class people.
Sure.
You know, I mean, so.
Well, Anna Hill is not upper class. I mean, it's not exclusively, and it's a little bit actually about the juxtaposition of classes and of work and not work. But it's not. It is not the great American poor novel.
Well, this is the case of Nick, who's initially introduced, you know, dumpster diving.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, there's sort of an interesting juxtaposition there, too.
Right, exactly.
A.M., thank you very much.
Hey, Ed, thank you very much.
A little bit more. Up and down, like a rising and falling star. Hit the sanctuary in the sound of 80 decibel guitar. He met a girl and he fell right into show. They fought each other all the way to rehabilitation. They brought each other so low to depths unknown to him.